Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Before we return to the second of the third statements that Yahweh etched in stone, we're in the midst of doing a comprehensive evaluation of all of the words that he chose, calling out the words that are most interesting in terms of elucidating our understanding relative to our knowledge of Yahweh and what he is offering, as well as how we might capitalize on the gift of the covenant. But before we turn to that today, Glenn called in during the last segment and has a statement or a question on deception and violence. Hello, Glenn. Good morning.
Right. Good morning. But certainly amen your lament at the end of the previous hour. But, you know, if the United States would simply submit all administration of its intelligence operations to the Mossad and all of its legislative operations to the ADL and the Southern Poverty Law Center, all lies and violence would stop.
Yeah, I think that you could do a number of things that would help. If it were me, I would shut down the NSA and the CIA, also the NGIC, which is the National Ground Intelligence Center just north of Charlottesville, Virginia, and all forms of military intelligence, as well as virtually everyone associated with Homeland Security. I would shut them down all tomorrow. America would be a safer, freer country if they were all shut down immediately. The second thing
that... JFK wanted to break the CIA into 1,000 pieces, and that didn't serve him too much.
You know, there are a number of books out on the history of the CIA. It is among the most reprehensible organizations of any nation, of any time. It is an extraordinarily disgusting organization. And the things that they have done around the world have been so counterproductive as to make enemies for the United States as opposed to friends. There's a reason that three South American countries have all offered asylum to Snowden. And that is because most countries in South America hate the United States because of the malfeasance of and the murders conducted in the political upheaval created by the CIA and in their countries. It is true that the Mossad is the best intelligence organization in the world. They are among the few national intelligence agencies that actually puts their own resources, embeds their own resources within their enemy. Mossad agents will actually risk their lives to work inside, for example, the Syrian government, to work inside the Iranian government, to work inside of terrorist organizations, Islamic organizations, and there is no other intelligence community in the world that does this today. You know, for example, the CIA bribes informants, and they bribe people like David Headley, who are actually plotting a terror while receiving money from the United States to do so. And the number of cases like that is overwhelming. As for ending most crime in America, if that was the goal, you wanted to put an end to most crime in America, all you would have to do is legalize drugs. Well, using cocaine and marijuana and heroin and other what are currently illegal drugs, methamphetamines, ecstasy, crystal meth, is stupid. It's counterproductive. You ought to be free to trash your own body and brain if you wish to. The government should not be in the business of telling you what you can and cannot consume. And if you realize that something
I have to pay for the hemodialysis,
there's a way to even deal with that, which is that the same thing I would do with alcoholism and smoking. If you get cancer because you smoke, if your liver fails because you drink, then if you can't pay for your own treatment, you cannot burden society with it. You're going to die, and that should be the consequence of making that choice. And so if somebody wants to fry their brain on illegal drugs, that's fine. That's their choice, and society ought not be trying to bail them out. But it ought not incarcerate them either. America is the largest prison nation on earth. We incarcerate a higher percentage of our citizens than any other nation by a huge margin. You know, we used to talk about the Soviet Union as being a penal state, of China as being a penal state. Well, the biggest penal state in the world is the United States. And so,
well, privatized, then now there's financial incentive for people to be sent there, and judges have been caught sending people there to work in the business operations of the privatized prisons.
You know, I'm actually a proponent of privatizing almost everything that government does, because a privatized prison is vastly more efficient than is anything run by the U.S. government. But the fact is that America has way too large a percentage of its population in prison, and most of them are in prison for drug-related charges, and we ought not be enriching those in the drug business. We ought not be imprisoning those who poison themselves with drugs. We ought to be spending and using our judicial resources in an entirely different way. Now, I'm not promoting drugs. It's stupid. I mean, if anything that you do that diminishes your capacity to think and to operate in life is counterproductive. You ought not to do it. But we ought not have government telling us what we can and cannot do, so long as what we do does not infringe on the rights of others. So if you want to poison yourself in your home, you ought to be able to do it. You get in the car while polluted, then that individual ought to spend a lot of time in jail. So we agree on that. Glenn, I'm going to turn now to Yaz's testimony. Thank you very much for those points. We are we're in agreement. Yahweh said, you should not do anything which associates yourself with a carved image or idol, any religious icon or an object of worship, or any visual representation of something which is in the heavens above or on the earth below, or which is in the waters beneath the land. You should not ever bow down and worship them or speak for them. That would preclude virtually every religious, political, and patriotic celebration. You should not ever bow down and worship them or speak for them. And you should not serve them. Now, that would also mean that you can't join the military, not without being in violation of this. Now, by the way, this is not a law. God is not saying that I am banning this. There's no ban. There is no law. This is not a commandment. This is not an order. God is just saying, this is, I'm providing instruction for you as to what is good for you and what is bad for you. I'm telling you that this is bad for you, and that because it's bad for you, there is a consequence of doing these things. So you should not ever bow down and worship them or speak for them, and you shall not serve them. For indeed, I, Yahweh, your God, am a zealous and jealous God, Kana El, a God who is desirous of exclusivity in a relationship, a God who is emotionally passionate and extremely protective of those he loves. Counting and reckoning, this is a consequence word, pakad, literally taking stock of and actually recording, assigning, and depositing the perversity and sin of twisting and distorting, awon. Awon is a concept almost identical to Babel. In Hebrew, of the concepts that God is concerned about, good and bad, there are many, many words. Like, there are many words for teaching, for example, in Hebrew. There are many words for twisting, distorting, and corrupting in Hebrew. The most commonly used is awon, but that is also the meaning of Babel, as in Babylon, which is the first requirement of the covenant, to walk away from Babylon. Counting the perversity and sin of twisting and distorting, of corrupting, of deviating from the way of the fathers. So it is our fathers, our forefathers, who have corrupted what God has told us. You know, you have Americans thinking that they are in a Christian nation founded on Christian principles. Well, that's just absolutely not true. Founding fathers of this country were Freemasons and a Jacobin. Now, it wouldn't have made a difference had they been Christians. They would have been just as wrong as if they were Freemasons and Jacobins. But the fact is that it's a myth. And then they created, ultimately through them, we create mythos in terms of honoring them almost as if they are national saints. We build shrines to them. Look at Abraham Lincoln, a grotesque racist. His view of African Americans, he didn't use that term, but this radio show wouldn't be able to be broadcast anymore if I actually used the term that he used. He said that those who had come from Africa were not fit to live in America, and he wanted them moved out so that they would have to have their own place totally segregated from Americans. That's why he didn't want slave and free states to be able to come into the United States willy-nilly. In his discussions, debates with Douglas, he wanted Africans rejected from society because he said they were incapable of integrating within the society. To call him the great emancipator, to call him the man who saved the nation when he destroyed its values, caused a war where over 600,000 of its sons were killed, is just astonishingly stupid. Everything he said about Africans was wrong. Everything he did relative to saving the Union was wrong. And yet we take his distortion and twisting and perversity and make him into an American icon, a founding father, a great image to look up to in his statues and worship. And when the fathers do this, the consequence is to their children, which is God is saying, that I'm going to reckon. Consequence of the twisting and corruption of the fathers approaches the children. Concerning the third and fourth generation, the actual word there is the fathers, ab, upon. The word really isn't upon, it's al. Al in Hebrew, can say upon, but it's a word that also suggests that comes upon, that in the sense of approaches the children. When we, as parents, teach our children political and religious myths that are corrupting and polluting, we bring this upon them. We bathe them in our ignorance, in our stupidity, in our foolishness. And those who do it because they're actually hostile to God while claiming to be on His side. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. After Yahweh tells us that we ought not be religious, that we ought not go into religious environments, we ought not bow down in worship, we ought not speak for those things which elicit our patronage, and that there is nothing that is more concerning to him than corruption, twisting and perverting his testimony, and that it is deadly for our children. He concludes that section by saying that those who do so genuinely hate and are hostile to me. This is one of the things that the Christians are unwilling to admit, but it's nonetheless irrefutable. By creating their New Testament and calling Yahweh's Torah, prophets, and Psalms the Old Testament, by turning this caricature that is modeled pretty much exclusively off Dionysus and Bacchus and Osiris and Tammuz, by calling him the God and praying to him as God and worshiping him as God, what they're in essence doing is saying, we don't want any part of that God of the Old Testament. Paul referred to Yahweh's plans, his strategy, his revelation, his methods of us engaging in the covenant and being saved by him, archaic, old, a system that no longer had any merit. He actually came up with the term, this old system was, he used the Greek word that's the basis of pornographic. And so that's the attitude that Christians have towards it. They think that the Torah is mean-spirited. According to Paul, it enslaves, that the God of this Old Testament cannot save. That he is mean-spirited. That he's a cruel disciplinarian. Paul says all those things. Christians believe it. Now, if you have that view of God, if you're willing to twist and distort what he actually said so that you and your children hold a negative attitude towards his Torah, towards his people, towards his covenant, that's why they have a new one, towards his testimony, his approach, when he says the one characteristic, I'm going to tell you about me so that you know who I am, I'm zealous and jealous, and you have Paul say that love is not jealous, which means what? That God's hateful. When you have that attitude, the attitude that Christians have, they actually are hostile to and actually despise the God of their Old Testament. Now, they would say, oh, no. We love God. That's why we pray to our Lord Jesus Christ. No. You renamed him. You disassociated him completely from Yahweh. You disassociated him completely from the Torah. You came up with a bunch of mythology that you associated with him, a birthday, an Easter celebration, that man killed God, a bodily resurrection. All of these things you applied from pagan mythology to him. You make him completely different than Yahweh, whose name you won't even say. The reality is Christianity indoctrinates believers into not only being hostile to the God of the Old Testament, but to actually hating Yahweh. A guy like Larry, who calls into the program often because he on Facebook engages with Christian apologists, those who promote the religion of Christianity. In those face group discussions, when he cites Yahweh's testimony as the reason that their religion is false, they are angry. They say, where did you find that rubbish? They say that he has no bearing on our religion. They'll cite Paul in defense of Yahweh. It is so unbelievably obvious that Christians have been indoctrinated to hating God. It's something that because religion so destroys the capacity of a person to be rational, that a Christian will not go through that process and say, well, yeah, I guess that's true. But it's undeniable. Now, as a loving father, Yahweh not only tells us the things that we ought not to do that have a consequence which is not good for us, but he also tells us what we should do that will have a positive result. Just as we, when raising our children, say, if you do these things, the results will be favorable. If you do these things, the results will be counterproductive. Do these, you ought not to do those. That's what we're going to consider on the What's Good for Us next. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're considering the advice that Yahweh gave us, and understand there is no Hebrew word for obey. God does not establish rules that we have to obey. None of the 10 statements that Yahweh etched in stones is a commandment. There's only one of the 10 that was written in the imperative mood, and that one is the one that is impossible even to construe as a command, because it's the one about valuing our mother and father. You can't command respect. And so what we find is the imperative, while it's the only mood in Hebrew that is capable of conveying the notion of a commandment, it primarily conveys volition. That I am, that with in the imperative mood, you are effectively saying that the thing that I desire, This would be, since it's Yahweh speaking, it's a first-person communication of volition. It would be Yahweh saying, the thing that I really desire, the thing that I care about, is that you respect, you value, you hold as significant your father and mother. Now, he has just said in this statement that fathers corrupt their children. So he's not talking about earthly fathers here. He's talking about the father of the covenant himself. And who's the mother? The Ruach Kodesh, feminine in Hebrew. She is assigned all maternal responsibilities as it relates to the covenant. God is interested in the covenant. That is all he cares about. And so the covenant, being a family relationship, has to be modeled on the human family, because the human family is the participants in the covenant, and therefore there must be a father, mother, and child. While there is no Trinity, and God is one, he manifests himself as father. He has maternal aspects, which he manifests through the Ruach Kodesh, the set-apart spirit. And he represents himself as the first child born into the covenant as Yahusha. And so Yahweh, as our father, in the role also of spiritual mother, is hereby not commanding that we do these things, but offering them as prescriptions for living, offering them as fatherly and motherly advice. Advice now, which if you follow, is good for you. If you reject, there will be a consequence. Here's the good advice. But I will genuinely act and actually engage to literally prepare, perform, and produce unmerited and unfailing mercy, unearned favor, and undeserved kindness on behalf of thousands who move toward me and love me, and also who approach me by closely observing and carefully consider my terms, the conditions of my covenant. All right. What has he said there? He used I. Who has he introduced himself as in the first of these statements? And who did he even reintroduce himself as in the midst of this second statement? Yahweh. Did he say, I, Jesus Christ, am the one who is going to engage to provide mercy? No. Did he say, I, as the Son, am going to engage to provide you with mercy? No. I, Yahweh, the one who said, I am jealous, because relationships mean everything to him, protecting, serving, nurturing, loving, caring for those he loves is essential to him. He said, I, this is Yahweh. If you're focusing on Jesus Christ, not only have you got no clue who he is, your focus is wrong. I, Yahweh, will genuinely act and actually engage. This was written in the call stem. To literally prepare, perform, and produce. God himself, Yahweh, is the one who engaged to save us. Yahweh himself is the one who served as the Passover lamb. Yahweh himself is the one that performed and produced everything that needed to be done for us to engage in the covenant relationship and to be saved by it. He is the source of mercy, not grace. Grace is the name of the Roman adaptation, the gratia, of the naked goddesses of licentiousness and merriment called the charis, the charities in Greece. Yahweh is the father of chesed, of mercy, unmerited and unfailing mercy, unearned favor and undeserved kindness. These, his mercy, is offered to his covenant children. They are the five benefits of the covenant. God makes us immortal, not because we deserve it, but because he wants to. He makes us perfect, not because our behavior makes us that way. No, because his behavior makes us that way. He adopts us into his family. He enriches us with his teaching. He empowers us with his spirit. These are all direct derivatives of his chesed mercy. Now, this next statement that is part of this is one of the most important in the totality of the Torah. That not only is it Yahweh himself that is merciful, is offering this undeserved favor, negating the entire premise of the Christian New Testament. It's trash. Throw it away based on this statement. Throw away any reverence for Jesus Christ based upon this statement. I, Yahweh, am the one who actually engaged to prepare, perform, and produce unmerited and unfailing mercy. But think of what follows on behalf of thousands. On behalf of thousands. Yahweh in the Torah speaks of hundreds of thousands elsewhere. He speaks of great numbers in terms of the overall descendants of Abraham. As, you know, being more than the stars that you can see in the night sky. He has a way of talking about hundreds of thousands, millions and billions. He very often communicates tens of thousands. He very often communicates hundreds of thousands. And he has the means, even within Hebrew, to communicate millions and billions. And does so in the Torah. He said thousands are going to be recipients of his mercy. Thousands amongst the billions who have come this way is one in a million. Is there any wonder that Yahusha said few will find a door to life, which is Passover, and that most will go the popular route to their own death and destruction, which is, what are the popular routes? Religion and politics. Religion and politics are always the popular route to their death and destruction. Few will find a narrow path that goes against the crowd that provides life. Thousands is one in a million. By stating this, just as by Yahusha making his statement at the beginning of his Sermon on the Mount, his instruction on the Mount, you have completely negated any possibility that any religion can be a means to salvation. God himself said few. God himself said thousands amongst billions. Very few people avail themselves of his mercy. It's not mean. It would be mean if he said, thousands will receive my mercy, and all of the rest are going to go to hell so that they can be tortured forever. That would be mean. But that's not what he says. The vast preponderance of those who do not avail themselves of his mercy by moving towards him, coming to love him, and closely observing and carefully considering the terms of his covenant, they simply cease to exist. No penalty. There's a consequence, but no penalty. So, in this statement, God completely undermined the entire basis of the Christian religion and the basis of Judaism. Doesn't need to undermine Islam. You've got to be an absolute moron to be a Muslim. But I will genuinely act and actually engage. When did God also act and engage? When he created the universe? When he conceived life? When he walked in the garden and taught and camped out with Adam, Chawa? When he saved Noah and his family from an earth that had become, particularly Mesopotamia, that had become so polluted, so corrupt, that man was just so reprehensible that there was no chance of the earth even surviving to this point in time. He engaged then too. And of course, he engaged with Abraham to create this covenant. Personally engaged. And he engaged again to honor the covenant, the promise he had made to Abraham, to Yishak, to Jacob, and freed his children from religious and political oppression, military and economic oppression in the crucibles of Egypt. He engaged again in year 4000 Yajus as he promised in the Torah, enabling the promises of Passover to make us immortal, unyeasted bread to make us perfect, Bukhudim, first fruits to adopt us into his family, and seven Sabbaths to empower and to enrich us. He has done what he said he was going to do. He talked the talk. He walked the walk. Ashah is not a passive term. Ashah doesn't say, I just delineated the means to unmerited and unfailing mercy. Ashah is, I affected and I engaged in, I acted upon the means to save you. And that is for thousands. There are billions of Christians alive today, expressly excluding the religion as being a means to mercy. Now, who is this mercy, these thousands amongst billions or one in a million? Who is it for? Those who move towards me, La, and Ahab, who love me. Are Christians moving toward God or away from him? Toward his testimony and his guidance in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, or away from it? Are Christians in love with Yahweh or with a caricature, a God of their own making? We'll return to Shattering Myths after the commercial break. Welcome back to Shattering Myths as we're considering the thousands who benefit from Yahweh's mercy, him personally engaging and acting. There might be some who say, well, that really isn't fair. How could he be merciful and allow all but one in a million people to have eternal life with him in heaven? And how everyone else except those who are guilty of corrupting and distorting his message and therefore polluting the world's children who end up being immortal, but eternally separated from him, that how could that be merciful to have created lives only to have them be extinguished? Well, that would be very much like a dog going to its mother and saying, because I'm going to die in 15 years of natural causes, you were unmerciful to create me. It would be like any living creature attacking, chastising the source of their birth, the male and female of their species who got together to give them birth and who actually helped nurture them. It'd be like going to them and saying, how could you have been so unmerciful to create me, knowing that in a number of years, whatever it be, whether it be a desert tortoise at 100 or a flea in 20 minutes, that I'm going to die. I'm going to cease to exist. How horrible of you. God gave us this whole universe, created this universe for us so that we could live. Gave us life. Revealed himself to us, said, if you want to live forever, here's the way. If you want to live for the amount of time that your mortal soul will enable that, that's fine too. I mean, I'm beside myself just to figure out how that's not merciful, how that's not loving, how that's not kind. To have given us life, to have given us this wonderful, beautiful, spectacular universe, and to have given us a text by which we can follow to transition from a mortal existence to an eternal existence and adopted into his family as his children. Well, God says that there are two things that perhaps there's three, depending on how you look at the preposition. Let's use them as three. Three things that we can do that avail ourselves of his mercy and therefore salvation. The first of those is the preposition law, which means to move toward. How do you move toward God? Well, God provided a path. There's only one path in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. Only one. That path begins by, what would you expect it to begin with? A doorway. All right. So there's a doorway to the path. The doorway represents life. There's a threshold, which is the second step on this path, which is the next day, which makes us perfect. And then there is the documentation process, the incorporation process. Once we're immortal and perfect, we gain the authenticity of, the inheritance of, becoming Yahweh's children. We become part of his family. That's the third step. The fourth step in this way is seven Shabbat, which is the promise of seven, where we are enriched with Yah's teaching, we're empowered with his spirit. One, two, three, four. Those are the first four steps on the way. Each of those have already been enabled because those first four steps and facilitate all of the benefits of the covenant, Yah's source of mercy. Now, there are three more. He'll fulfill them over the next 20 years. The next of those is Teruah, which means to sound an alarm, to share the good news. Those of us who have benefited from the first four, Moed Mikre, who are God's spirit-filled troubadours, who have been enriched with his Torah teaching and guidance, are in a position to do what we're doing right now as part of this program. Share his testimony, share his offer, share who he is, so that other people could follow us. Not follow us in terms of our example, follow the same path that we're on, which is the one that God not only delineated, but the one he himself enabled, acting upon it, fulfilling this statement that he has etched in stone. The next day is the Day of Reconciliations. The purpose of the Day of Reconciliations is to reconcile his covenant relationship with the literal descendants of Abraham, Yitzhak, and Jacob, Yisrael, and Yehuda, ultimately leading to God's home. That's why this is the path to him, to approach him. Sukkah represents his home where we camp out with him. And tomorrow's program will consider the next two aspects of the things that God is encouraging us to do if we want to be recipients of his mercy, which is to love him, which requires knowing him and understanding what he is offering, as well as observing what he has said.